In our inaugural episode of E equals MC Squared, looking beyond the Asian American stereotype, a few of our guests and ourselves studied the recent events regarding anti-Asian hate, along with our experience in our education and life.
We also realized that the COVID-19 pandemic has greatly impacted Asian reputation in the U.S. Although we are sure most of you know, the COVID-19 virus originated in Wuhan, China, in the fall of 2020, and has spread across the globe, claiming the lives of thousands. To us now, wearing masks and socially distancing is a reality, but also, growing blame and hatred towards Asians has also become a reality during these times.
Joining us today are Dr. Justin Chen and Dr. Juliana Chen from Mass General Hospital. Dr. Justin Chen and Dr. Julia Chen work with MGH in Harvard Medical School in order to support the emotional wellness of diverse adolescents, providing resources and services for students and families. In addition, we will be speaking with running mayoral candidate Michelle Wu about how the virus and other various stereotypes, expectations, and parenting methods have affected many Asians' mental health and safety.
We would like to start our episode by welcoming Dr. Justin Chen and Dr. Juliana Chen.
My first question, I guess, to kind of jumpstart this conversation is, I guess it's probably well known that Asian American adolescents, they have more difficulties with like their mental health. I guess, who do you think is responsible? Because it's a difficult question and it's a large one, but it's kind of juggling between parents, kids, school, pressures, external factors. I guess in your minds, what is one of the largest reasons?
I'll take a stab. Juliana, go ahead.
Go ahead. No, go ahead, Justin, and then I'll add on.
I was going to say, you know, this is a hard question because I don't know that it's necessarily useful to sort of pin blame, if that makes sense. I think most situations that we deal with as clinicians are co-created. You know, there's many different factors. And so when I think about, you know, mental health problems are inevitable. There's no group that doesn't have them, right? They affect all of us. One of the things that we notice, I think, in our population in Asian American youth is really the difficulties and the barriers to getting care. And so when I think about that, you know, so everyone's going to struggle at some point, that's normal. But then how easy is it to actually address those, to know what those are, and then to get help for it? And I think about, you know, kind of the importance of both structural and cultural barriers. So in terms of structural ones, there's a lot. Think about just the cost and the expense and the time it takes to get help, it's not easy. And for young people who may be in school, et cetera, it's actually not that clear how to start. Mental health care is hard to access for everyone, not just for Asian Americans. But then when you add in that extra layer of culture, you know, and thinking about, will this clinician understand me? Will they understand my relationship with my parents? Other factors that might be very important to us, then you're just adding more and more barriers. And then I do think there are cultural contributions to the difficulty with help seeking. I think, you know, we tend to be a culture that prizes sort of emotion inhibition or even just sort of keeping it in and tolerating or overcoming. There's also, I think, just a different belief in what causes these symptoms. You know, whereas in the West, we might label something as mild to moderate depression or anxiety. I think for some of my patients, what you hear is, I'm just not working hard enough, I'm lazy, which is a really kind of two-dimensional way of understanding why someone, it's not like, how do we understand this, but more like, oh, I wish I could just work harder. So let me pause there. I know Juliana will have more to add.
Oh no, I so appreciate that. And it is such a big, good question. And I'm so glad you started off with it. To add on to some of what Jess was saying, and I think we'll probably get to this over the course of our time together, culture can be a big factor, communication be a big factor, and want to be really, really careful and mindful, right? That, as Justin mentioned, mental health issues are not limited to Asian American students. There is evidence of some heightened risk in certain areas, but certainly this is not exclusive in Asian piece. And in terms of cause, because that was part of the original question, perhaps overly simplistic, but in medicine, in psychiatry and psychology, we think about things. One framework is called the biopsychosocial model, which you both have maybe heard about. And this is the idea that it's the overlay of lots of different factors that kind of all line up that might put someone at additional risk. So biopsychosocial the bio is perhaps the easiest to first think of, kind of the biological. So many people might have a genetic predisposition to mental health disorders, maybe an increased risk of depression in the family, just kind of like family history and genetics and things like then psychological and behavioral factors, things like, you know, how a person thinks about themselves or self-esteem or what someone's coping abilities are to manage stress. And then social factors, you know, things like our environment, right? Our family relationships, this is where culture comes into play and friendship. So knowing that there are all these different factors that all might line up, and having a genetic, you know, risk or family history of depression doesn't necessarily mean that you're definitely going to get depression. Same as if there is a family history of heart attack, doesn't necessarily mean that you're going to have one, but you might have a higher risk. And then when you add in these psychological factors and social factors, you can kind of see how those risks might line up in a certain way. So someone might be more likely to struggle with mental health issues. So that's one framework that hopefully helps boil it down a little bit.
Can I follow that up quickly? You made me think of something else, Juliana, which is the model minority myth that we are hearing a lot about these days. And I think that's yet another factor that affects us, because, you know, already if there is kind of a cultural pressure to keep it in, and also certainly to not kind of, you know, you want to do well, you want to like make your parents proud, et cetera. And so you add in the model minority myth, which sort of tells us, you know, gives us an external message from society that, yeah, you're also not supposed to, you're supposed to all be very successful and, you know, everyone should be good at math and whatnot. It just colludes the two things, I think, combined. And so it makes it really hard to ask for any sort of help. You know, you're supposed to be very self-sufficient and capable. So any even academic help, let alone mental health help.
Yeah, I agree. I think, like, especially in Asian American cultures, there is like a stigma around mental health. In the fact that I know a bunch of people, typically the older generation, who, I don't know, if they can't see it, doesn't exist. That kind of mentality, that's a little bit difficult to overcome. Audrey, were you going to say something?
Yeah, you actually literally took out what I was exactly going to say.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I've had personal experiences where, you know, as I'm a second generation, so my parents immigrated here. So their culture is extremely different, because they grew up, you know, in a rural part of China, I would say, where like everything was, they had to do everything by themselves. They didn't have as much support as we do. But I think a big problem that I see is sometimes parents bring their culture with them and say like, oh, we experienced this when we were younger, so we're expecting the same out of our children. But the society is evolving. And things are changing. Things aren't the exact same as they were before then. And it's also, you know, we're halfway across the world. So I think it takes a little time for, you know, my parents, and I know some of my friends' parents, to kind of make, for their parents to make that psychological switch and kind of be more open to like Western medicine and different things that are like here in America.
Audrey, I so appreciate your observation, both of yours. And I think that's exactly right. And I think, I don't want to speak for you, Justin, but you and I have talked enough over the years that I think that you would agree. I think this is why we really don't like to think about things in terms of blame, right? Because our parents' culture or where they came from and what they know, like, that was their experience. That was their growing up. And for them to come to this country, right, where things are going to be different, the culture is different. And so I don't think of it as, you know, one culture is better than the other. Both are amazing, but they're different. And I'm being overly simplistic, but I think this is definitely true. A lot of children of immigrant parents, not just Asian families or within Asian families, can struggle with this, right? Because parents are coming with one way of communicating, certain styles and values, certain approaches to parenting that might be a little bit different or might be dramatically different than how things are done here in the U.S. And so that difference or that divide can sometimes be hard, and that I don't think that's blaming anyone, but I do think that can be a source of difficulty or tension. I'll pause there because I know there's a lot more to probably say on this topic.
Totally agree with you, Juliana. And, you know, we think about our parents and the way that they raised us is often the way they were raised. And that's true of all parents, right? You sort of think about where did this all begin? So, you know, I'm not in the custom of talking to my parents a lot about their childhood, although as we've all grown older, we get a little more glimpses, but I think that they're behaving in the way that they, you know, were taught is appropriate for a parent to behave. And you also think about the cultural roots of that. We're talking about Chinese culture here, so we can't stereotype to all Asians, but, you know, in Confucian philosophy, you know, a lot of these directives are one way. It's, you know, parents are have a lot of duties towards their kids. So the kids have their duties towards their parents. The parents' duty in Confucian culture is to basically provide so that they can, the child can, it's like a plant metaphor, they can basically grow and take in all the nutrients and support. And I think on the one hand, that's amazing. Like, it's so beautiful. And we all have those experiences of parents kind of like bringing the cut fruit and all that to kind of really support. The flip side of that is it can be also tremendously burdensome. And so that's something we sometimes hear from our patients and students about, wow, I've got all of this investment in me. And so there's sort of like, what is mine versus what is theirs? The other thing I want to say also, depending on the, you know, it's not just culture, there's also so many factors related to identity. And I like the addressing acronym. Some of you may use a different one. It's called Addressing from Pamela Hayes, a psychologist. And it stands for like age and generational status, disabilities, like acquired and developmental disabilities. R is like religion, spirituality, et cetera, et cetera. So you can think about all these ways. Of course, a huge one is socioeconomic status. And for many immigrants, you know, they came from a situation where maybe they didn't have nearly as much economic opportunity. And so they sacrificed a ton, you know, often this is a common story, right, to give us opportunities that they didn't have. But when you think about it through a psychological lens, there's the Maslow's hierarchy of needs, which you may have heard of. This is the idea that, you know, as humans to sort of progress in our own development, there are certain basic things that need to be there first that are foundational. And the very basic ones are like security, shelter, food, and water. And so I think when people didn't have that as much, of course it makes sense that they're gonna say, we didn't have time to think about mental health. We just like, we're doing whatever it took to survive. And it's not to say that those upper levels, like the upper levels of Maslow's hierarchy are like relationships and self-actualization. Those are very important, but you know, you need those lower levels. And so that's some of the work that we in our center do is to try to talk to parents and again, sort of come from a place of you love your kids, you know that you want the best for them. And part of that best involves these other things that maybe you didn't talk about as much in your own childhoods growing up.
Yeah, I don't know if you guys know the comedian Ali Wong.
Mm-hmm.
She's an hilarious
comedian. Fantastic.
Yeah, I was actually listening to her audiobook the other day, and she was discussing how when she went back to her mother's homeland, I believe, how she kind of looked around and saw a bunch of hardworking people who were trying to kind of make a living and make a life for themselves. And as such, I think she noticed that there was, I don't know how you describe it, there was mental health wasn't the first thing on their mind. And what I think is interesting is how you mentioned, Justin, kind of how like our parents and their parents, they kind of grew up with that same mentality. And I am actually, I believe that the technical term is like third generation where my parents grew up here. So my parents have kind of been a little bit more immersed in like, I don't know, quote unquote, American culture and like their American ideals of like mental health. So you can definitely see how a change in like growing up in certain cultures kind of brings about a different viewpoint in like when I talk to my grandmother versus when I talk to my parents.
And
Go ahead.
I was just gonna say like I do feel like there's a lot about like communication between parent and child. That's like really important, and I think in some cultures it's just a little bit hard to kind of fully understand each other, the child and parent relationship. But a lot of part I found is even more people tend to say like, oh, it's like our parents have a lot of pressure on Asians, but in a sense, you know, kind of going back to like the Asian model minority, it's also within our culture just to give ourselves a great deal of pressure. It's just, and it's something that like everyone does, but I've just seen a lot, like with my classmates and friends, that just a lot of Asians hold themselves to very high standards, especially like if you have older siblings or people who you know, you tend to, you know, set them as a standard and you feel like you have to meet that standard or exceed it.
And so I think it's also important that you make the distinction that we talked a lot about, like, the importance of parenting before, but there's also, there's a lot more to, like, mental health than just what a parent can affect. It's also, the biggest part I would say is just within how you yourself actually go about doing things and how you feel. And I think that people kind of misunderstand that, you know, it's within our culture just to give ourselves quite a bit of pressure.
I really appreciate that point, Audrey. And I think, again, at the risk of oversimplifying, I think there's a lot of data to support that, like, this current generations of teens and young adults, you know, are struggling. There are higher rates of anxiety and depression that we're seeing across the board, not necessarily just within Asian families. And I think we already touched a little bit on the model minority myth and how that's very, very real, this myth. And when you're talking about the pressure that students may feel, and again, at the risk of oversimplifying, I think this happens in a lot of immigrant families where I think I felt this way, certainly because my parents immigrated here. And I have an understanding to the extent that they've shared with me their journey and kind of all that they sacrificed to come. And so I think that's a pretty common experience, you know, for parents who've come here. They've had to leave their homeland, their country, their families, had to shift so many things, learn a new language, learn a new culture. Every family story is unique and different, but each has its, you know, history of sacrifice. And I think children of immigrant parents or grandparents, like, we know that's our lineage, so to speak. And I think even if it's never explicitly said, and some of this I think is in the Asian culture, right? But we are very aware of that. We're aware of the family. And I think there can also be an additional pressure to make our family proud or make that sacrifice, quote unquote, worth it, whatever that means, if that makes sense. And I think that's just like another layer to perhaps the added pressure that Asian American students may feel, and why it might be hard to sometimes speak up, on top of already the layers, the cultural and communication challenges that we've already alluded to.
I totally agree. So many thoughts came to mind, Audrey, as we were talking. One was that scene from the movie Crazy Rich Asians. I don't know if you guys have seen that, but there's that great scene, and I use this in my talks to illustrate cross-cultural difference, where the character played by Constance Wu is like meeting, so she's like the hotshot professor from NYU meeting her prospective mother-in-law for the first time in the kitchen, and it's played like a mother. I just rewatched this movie actually because I loved for the cultural piece, but there's so many details. Like the mother's not really looking at her, and then she sort of asks her, like, well, tell me about yourself. And she tells her story about being raised by a single mom who was really, like, you know, sacrificing to support her to pursue her dream to become an economics professor at NYU, pretty fancy. And in response, Michelle Yeoh doesn't say, oh, that's amazing. She says, pursuing one's passion, how American. And you know, when she says that, it's not a positive thing, right? And so you sort of see the clash right there, because, and that's like one of the themes in the movie about self-sacrifice for the sake of family. And that was Michelle's whole story. You know, you sort of understand the person behind that kind of cutting remark. So that's one thing I wanted to mention is just sort of, yeah, this theme of sacrificing for someone else. But it gets confusing, I think, sometimes when the boundaries aren't so clear. And it's like, well, what if what I want conflicts with what my parents want? And of course we want to do what's best, what's seen as best, and we want to be to please them, but sometimes it's really not a good fit, either because of your interest or because of just talent level. You know, not everyone should be a doctor. I really think that's true, and yet sometimes we get those messages. The other thing I want to say, though, that gets back to your first question that you started us with, like, whose fault is it? In a way, like, this is part of the issue. Culture is co-created. So I've definitely had students come and say, my parents never pressured me, but they were Asian. And they just had this sense that I just need to, like, it's never good enough. And that's, again, that sort of model minority. But also, I feel like we are all creating this all the time. And so one of the things I love to talk to families about and kids is to say, let's think about what does success mean? Really think about it, because I think we sometimes get into autopilot, right? It's like, you know, a certain cultural script is you go to these schools, you get these degrees, you make this much money, and then you're successful. And I think we all know that's not necessarily true. Like, you can do that and then become a miserable doctor, lawyer, engineer, etc. Or you could be happy. It's not to demean those careers, but I think it's sort of rethinking what are the messages that we get? And also, what are we putting out there? You know, I think about that with social media and how toxic it can be sometimes when images of success are kind of paraded in front of you. Or I've seen a number of students from MIT, and I'm not going to obviously reveal any patient information here, but just to say, you know, I feel like depending on your academic environment and the messages that are sent about what is successful, it can be actually very unrealistic. And someone might say, you know, if I haven't founded like a tech startup by the time I'm 22, that means I'm not nearly as good as the other people. But it's a very narrow definition of success. So I would challenge everyone listening to kind of think about, you know, at the end of the day, what actually matters. And, you know, for some people, it might be different. And then you have to negotiate that if your parents or family don't necessarily agree with you.
I so appreciate that, Justin. If I could just add on, maybe it will sound cliche, but it bears repeating, right? And we actually know this to be true for researchers who look at this, that job title, academic success, career success, your salary, that these are not things that necessarily equate to happiness, you know? Some basic salary to kind of support you and your family, kind of that's the bottom of that Maslow's hierarchy that Justin was just talking about. But higher than that, there actually isn't increased happiness at all. So I think that's something important to note. And then Justin, to your point about culture being co-created, I so appreciate that. And the fact that it's not just co-created by parent child, like within the family, right? Culture is also in our community, our neighborhoods, our schools, the larger US, right? Whatever stereotypes, model minority and beyond, or at MIT, not to criticize MIT, right? But you're from a high achieving school, a high achieving high school. Are you in a community with lots of Asians and lots of different kinds of Asians? Are you the only Asian in your community? There are going to be so many factors that go in. And then this reminds me of, Audrey, your point I think you were making a little bit earlier, but this idea of how it's not just about parents, or what I heard, you know, it's not just about parents or blaming parents or parent child, but this idea of stress in oneself. And I'm a child and adolescent psychiatrist, so I spend most of my time working with kids, teens, and helping parents support kids and teens. And that is a message I'm always giving to all of my patients, the importance for all people, right, to kind of know oneself. This message is true for adults too, but I kind of want to teach kids when they're younger, right? Do you know how you're doing? Do you know how you're feeling? Can you tell when you're stressed? Some kids and teens, I think, are just so accustomed to working and they don't even think of the stress as something that's problematic. They just think it's, I think that it's like almost like it's required or part of the process of being a good student. But stress is actually so, so, so bad for us. And so, yes, you can try to achieve things, but while you're doing it, can you be aware of your emotional state? Do you know what makes you more stressed or less? Do you know what you can do to help yourself feel better when you're having a hard time? Do you have coping skills? Do you have coping strategies? Do you have people in your corner, if not your parents and someone else to talk to? These are kind of like fundamental good ways to take care of our emotional health. And again, perhaps stating the obvious, but just like we all have physical health, we all have emotional health and mental health. And just like there are things we can all do and ideally should be doing to take care of our physical health, there are things that we can be doing to protect our emotional health and mental health. So even if we have perhaps risk factors, right? Family history of depression, we've had a lot of difficulty and stress as we were growing up. And there are things we can do to protect our mental health, to guard against those things. And so while mental illness is common and universal, mental symptoms are universal, right? There are things we can do to potentially certainly treat mental illness. Mental illness is common, it's treatable. And in some cases, it's actually preventable. Because if we take care of our stress and sleep well and eat well and all those things that our parents are always telling us to do, and that was so annoying, right? Are you sleeping? Are you eating? But they're actually right. They're really, really, really good for us, physical health and emotional health. So I think that's really, really important. So I wanted to bring that back because Audrey, I really appreciated you making that point earlier.
I think, you know, if for anything mental health related, you know, if you're just containing everything to yourself, it's going to be really hard to, you know, figure it out in anyways. This happens for anyone, Asian or any other race, is that you just need to reach out. I don't know, stuff like that. And also just like
way, I guess ways people can reach out or kind of deal with some mental health things or just some things, like words of advice, I would say, to young Asian communities.
I love that, Audrey, and agree with everything that you said. And again, it may sound simplistic, but these things really kind of matter. And in times of stress, which I think this is one of those things, kind of like the basics matter all the time, but they matter especially now. So as simplistic as it is, kind of really just taking care of the foundational stuff that I mentioned earlier. I know your students and a lot of your listeners are probably students and it's the end of the year. And I know I remember well, medical school and residency and fellowship do not support good, healthy habits, but things like getting a good night's sleep, really and truly. Teenage and young adult brains still need 9 to 9.5 hours of sleep. We know this. And I know so few teens and young adults who are getting that much sleep. So getting a good night's sleep, eating some regular, doesn't mean you can't enjoy fun foods, but, you know, kind of eating regularly, not having extreme eating too much or too little, moving your body in some way, even if you're not a big athlete, that's okay. If it's even going out for walks, being outside, connecting with nature, connecting with friends, these things are actually therapeutic and good for us. And so yes, study for that exam, but taking breaks is actually good for our brain and can help us like memorize and learn things better and will actually help you to perform better too. I would also say trying to tune in into self-compassion to the extent that you can, and this can take some practice, especially if you are high achieving or leaning towards anxiety, but self-compassion is a really, really, really important skill. And I would say one of the most important ones. So can you lean into self and compassion, meaning being kind to yourself, being patient to yourself, taking those breaks that you mentioned? And just to reiterate what you were saying earlier, Audrey, definitely reaching out, but I guess the corollary to that is reach out to each other, because like your friend connections, especially when you're at school, or if you're someone who isn't close with your family, or perhaps communication about mental health or stress is harder there, it's kind of where you need to rely on those other people in our lives. And sometimes reaching out and asking for help, as we just talked about, can be really, really hard. So can you reach out to each other, connect with each other? Don't worry alone for yourself, but also if you have a worry about a friend, check in with that friend. And it really, really makes a difference. And the last thing I'll add to that, though, of course, there are so many more things we could do, but I would say also all of us being open to sharing feelings and being vulnerable, because that's part of how we dispel the culture, right? Of this idea of we have to always save face or put the best face forward and always having things to be good. So it's hard, but can we share when we're having a hard time or when we didn't perform as well as we thought or we didn't get the acceptance into a program that we wanted? Can we share to normalize disappointments and normalize hard times? And that can help it be over time more talkaboutable in our friend groups and our families and community.
I love that, Julianne. I'll just piggyback because I was actually going to start by saying the vulnerability piece. I think, you know, we talked a lot about how stigma and shame is so prevalent, perhaps culturally. And I really believe that the antidote to stigma and shame is vulnerability and self-disclosure. So the more that, right, we recognize that everyone struggles, everyone has stresses, everyone is rejected from things, you know, it's not necessarily, shouldn't have to be such a terrible thing. And the more we could talk about it, the more it wouldn't have such a power over us. And along those lines, you know, it's a lot of what our center is trying to do. I want to put in a plug. We just were in the process of releasing a series of videos, and it's an interview with the Olympic figure skater Mirai Nagasu, who's a Japanese American from California. And her just very openly and courageously sharing, you know, all the things that you would probably not surprise anyone that someone would go through when operating at such an elite level. But we're really having this conversation. And actually this Saturday, there'll be a live event with Dr. Juliana Chen moderating and Dr. Mai Uchida, who's one of our center faculty, and she runs the MGH Child Depression Program. And Mirai Nagasu herself will be there. So the videos we can put this, I'll give you the information, but folks can go watch the pre-recorded videos, which are really moving, and then come to the event. And we're going to be talking about topics like achievement, perfectionism, Asian American identity, racism, et cetera. So, right, we really think that's a very important piece of the stigma reduction, is sort of getting people to realize you're not alone. This is actually quite normal.
Our next guest is Councillor Michelle Wu, who is actively campaigning for Boston mayor. I had the honor of speaking with her and asking a few questions about her role as an Asian woman in the government. As a young Asian woman myself, I was extremely interested in her perspective on the recent growth of anti-Asian hate crimes and how the virus has impacted Asians' reputation in the U.S. Additionally, Michelle was able to share her thoughts on Asian injustice long before the pandemic and throughout the Boston area. And this is what she had to say.
So first, thanks for joining. Really excited about your podcast. You know, we saw the impact of COVID-19 hitting Chinatown and other Asian American communities long before COVID-19 was spreading in the United States, back almost a year and a half ago, last February. We already noticed just a dramatic decline in business and in foot traffic through Chinatown, really fueled by the racism and xenophobia of former president and his allies scapegoating Asian Americans and using racist names for the virus itself. And so we had mobilized locally to draw attention to the issue and try to dispel at least that misinformation and call out this anti-Asian racism. But this is nothing new. And over the last year plus, it has accelerated into anti-Asian racism and violence and horrific attacks. And we know that this is part of a history of cyclical scapegoating of Asian Americans in this country and otherizing of community members, really emphasizing the perpetual foreigner stereotypes and contributing to an ongoing sense of invisibility. I hear from so many constituents in Boston who are Asian American and worried about their safety, worried about family members. We know the data has emphasized also the concerns that families are still experiencing. If you look at the percentage of families choosing to return to Boston Public Schools 5 days a week in person versus staying on a 5 days a week or versus being 5 days a week remote online from home, the Asian American community's choices have been very disproportionately different, way more hesitant to send students back in person. And so, you know, we need to ensure that there's not only support and awareness and every possible resource to ensure that families feel safe and are safe, but to realize that there are many situations in which communities are being marginalized and facing violence on a daily basis that long predate COVID-19. Workers going into unsafe working conditions, having to choose between putting food on the table and facing violence, particularly women of color and elders at risk. And so this is a moment to speak out and to build infrastructure and organizing across the communities to end racism.
It's really fascinating how Councillor Wu has noticed during her campaign the trend that Asian parents generally are reluctant to send their children back to school during the virus. It just shows how uncomfortable some Asian households are sending kids back to places where they might receive or experience some racism or xenophobia. And when Michelle was asked about her initiative for running as a candidate and possibly becoming the first Asian American mayor, she replied,
"I became the first candidate to announce a mayoral campaign way back in September. And at that moment, it was a very different potential candidate field, a very different potential race. But for me, this was never about who else might be in the field or what the odds were. This is about an incredibly consequential moment in Boston and the opportunity we have to come together as a city and build a Boston for everyone. I've personally lived how big the gaps are that families are facing. As someone who comes from an immigrant family, who raised my sisters when my mom was struggling with mental illness, and I've now had the chance to see just how much we can do, how powerful our city government is to take action and to deliver progress with 8 years on the council and time working for Mayor Menino before that. So our vision is for Boston to be bold and do more, not just to put band-aids on situations in this moment of recovery, but to truly address the underlying crises that our communities were facing long before COVID-19.
I find it quite extraordinary how Councillor Wu is unafraid to be bold and take actions for the vision she has for the city. And I hope we can all learn from her to be strong and certain in our words and opinions. You know, being an Asian woman living in Boston, I've only found myself just starting to speak out and be honest in my feelings. I think hearing Michelle tell her story and her burning desire to run and push through Asian stereotypes, such as assumptions regarding an Asian's ability to be a good speaker or to take a government position and lead a group of predominantly white men, is a message of hope and perseverance to many of us. Running for a role which has often been occupied by white men is extremely admirable. Michelle also attended Harvard University, located just across the river from BUA, and she shared her experience and struggles attending school in the Boston area as a child of immigrant parents.
Yeah, shout out to all the Quadlings and Courier House residents. There's no way that I would be in this role if I hadn't had so many doors open through the incredible education that I've been able to experience and the connections to community that started when I was at Harvard. I fell in love with the city of Boston through riding the Red Line every weekend from Harvard Square to Boston to volunteer in Chinatown, teaching citizenship classes and getting connected to the community. I saw so many residents who reminded me of my own family and all the sacrifices that my parents had gone through, working incredibly hard to get a foothold for their own families. And I saw a city where there seemed to be services on all topics, right, wrapping around this community, and the potential to really thrive and break down those barriers for residents. I did not attend any political events in my time in college. Even through graduation from undergrad, the thought had not crossed my mind that one day I might run for office. It's, you know, something that was far away from what my family ever was hoping for us. And in my family's multi-generational immigration story, politics was often associated with very scary things that the family was trying to get away from. My grandparents on both sides fled civil war in China over to the island of Taiwan. And then my parents immigrated from Taiwan to the United States. And so we were very much isolated and supposed to be shielded from politics. But towards the end of my time, as I was graduating from college, my mom was starting to show symptoms of mental illness. And it was really through the background and the sense of connection to community that I found my way back to Boston in the midst of her struggles and our family struggles. And the city has given my family everything we cherish, and in being able to find a life here, to build a life here where I get to live with my husband and two boys and upstairs and my mom downstairs after the healthcare that she's gotten here. I've raised my sisters in the city and had the chance to serve Boston, starting from when I was back at the law school at Harvard and finding my way across the river once again to work for Mayor Menino, first as an intern and then an employee, a special assistant on policies and sorting out the ways in which we could do more for families and move towards a more urgent set of opportunities, closing gaps that my family had gone through. So it's really been foundational. I walked into my first day of law school at Harvard, meeting Elizabeth Warren as my contracts law professor, and that was a coincidence that connected me to politics. I worked on her campaign, which her first campaign for the Senate, which took place during my 3L year of law school, and would not otherwise have gotten any exposure or connected to just how important it is, not just to have good policies, but to get the politics right, to bring more people into the political process and to see the difference that a candidate and a campaign can make in building the movement to deliver change in office.
I think this part really hit home for me. Although I am not in college yet, my parents also immigrated to the United States for their own studies, and I've experienced some struggles in my family and dealt with the pressure of life in general. And in those times when I feel like giving up, I always find myself gravitating towards the things which I find comfort in. And to Michelle, that comfort is being in the heart of Boston. I formed many of my own opinions from talking to Counselor Wu, and I reflected on many of her wishes and her thoughts, but I was curious to see what advice she truly wanted to give to the younger generation, including us, and specifically minorities. This is what she had to say.
Don't wait to have your impact. When I ran for office the first time, many well-intentioned mentor figures and others who were experts gave me well-meaning advice to wait and get my years of experience in, get more credibility before running for office. And so many others had been told the same thing. And so we had a city council in 2013 where out of 13 members, there was one woman serving. And when I was elected that year, we doubled the numbers from 1 to 2. And we also started to push for not just changing the policies, but the politics, to prove that it was possible for candidates of color and young people and women of color to win these seats, to change the dynamic in throughout the political ecosystem of why city council matters and who should be in these seats, to the point where just a few election cycles later, we elected our first ever majority of women and majority of people of color to the Boston City Council. And I really believe that so much of the initial barrier was that people kept saying it was impossible for candidates to win. And so people weren't running, the community, I mean, it was self-reinforcing. And so I've been really excited to see how quickly you can change those dynamics of changing the conversation on what's possible for on the politics, on the policies. And it starts by following your heart. When you know that you can make a difference, when you know that you can have impact, don't wait for other people to tell you that you're ready, because we need your leadership as soon as you feel ready to contribute it.
I think I've learned a lot from chatting to Michelle Wu. But for the Asian community, she has shown undeniable perseverance and courage through her journey. I believe that she shares many opinions with us too, and recognizes the problems regarding minorities and xenophobia. Her life started as an Asian American growing up in America, which can be easily mirrored in many students at BOA. Yet it has grown and cultivated into an inspirational career. I hope everyone can check out Counselor Wu's campaign and her initiatives to learn more about her vision for Boston.
I am extremely thankful for her willingness to chat with me previously, and I wish her the best of luck on her campaign.
As the school year winds out to a close, I hope that the BUA community and beyond can bring these lessons with them in the summer and back to BUA next fall. I believe that this podcast is a very small step to introducing topics relating to Asian discrimination and stereotypes, and I hope we can continue together to advocate until equality is achieved. Once again, we would like to thank our guests on this episode, Dr. Justin Chen, Dr. Juliana Chen, and Counselor Michelle Wu.
We hope that you will continue to listen to this podcast and hopefully feel a bit more educated on AAPI communities. Once again, we would also like to invite those to wish you to look at standwithasianamericans.com for more detailed information about the Asian American community and ways which you can donate or help support. Additionally, AAPIP.org is another great resource for those who wish to learn more about the Asian community.
We thank everyone for listening to our podcast. While we might be taking a break for the summer, we hope to continue the podcast in fall of 2021 and continue to spread our knowledge and perspectives. Thank you for listening.
Thank you.